to Orphaned Entertainment, a podcast dedicated to public domain and abandoned media. I'm your host, Christopher, and joining me is a woman who will not be silent. It's Lydia.
If I was, it would be a pretty boring podcast, wouldn't it?
It absolutely would. I won't take that as any kind of an insult.
Oh, no. I didn't even mean it that way. I just meant like it would be weird because you would say something and then you'd say, right, Lydia?
Lydia nods.
Lydia, insert nod here. Yeah. So, not to imply in any way, shape, or form that you're dull, Christopher. Only that one-sided conversations do come across as rather odd.
Yes, very much. Before we go any further, thanks to everyone for tuning in to this month's episode. Orphan Entertainment is available wherever you get your podcasts and wherever you choose to listen. If you have the option to do so, please rate and review the show. It does help get the show in front of more eyes and hopefully in more ears. You can follow the link in the show notes to all our social media sites, as well as our YouTube channel, where you can watch many of the films we have covered here on the show. And if you'd like to email us with any comments, suggestions, or feedback on this or any episode, please type or record a message and send it to orphanedentertainment@gmail.com. Let's listen to an Ellery Queen one-minute mystery and a promo for another podcast. And when we return, we will give voice to the silent drama, Beau Jest.
Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with the case I call the Deep Sea Murder. When a young scuba diver was found murdered, his equipment tampered with, it appeared to be the work of a fellow diver. I questioned him at length. I don't think you can prove I did anything to his equipment, he said confidently. Besides, I rather think he panicked in the deep water and tried to get to the surface in a hurry. Sounds like a good alibi, doesn't it? It was for a while, I replied, but you're guilty of murder. In a moment, I'll tell you why.
Most food critics are all about those fancy high-end meals no one can actually afford. But what about the rest of us? Who's got our back? Join me, your host, Michael Ornelas, each week on the Fine Dining Podcast as I subject my taste buds to the tepid offerings of every chain restaurant in America. IHOP?
Done.
Cracker Barrel?
Without a doubt.
P.F. Chang's?
You bet I've been there too.
It's my mission to find the ultimate mediocre dining experience, because who said mid can't be magnificent? It's not fancy dining, but it's fine dining. Check out the Fine Dining Podcast wherever you prefer to listen.
In the case of the deep sea murder, the suspect knew you cannot surface quickly from a deep dive. His statement that the victim tried to get to the surface in a hurry proved his guilt. He shouldn't have made that statement. He hasn't made many more either. Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Beau Jest is a 1926 silent film directed by Herbert Brennan, and it is based on the 1924 novel by the same name written by P.C. Wren. The film stars Ronald Colman and some actors we've seen before on the show, albeit a little later in their careers, including Neil Hamilton, The Devil's Hand, and William Powell, who we just watched last month in the Green Murder case. I'm honestly not sure if I knew he was in this film.
I don't think I did either. I think I just recognized Beau Jest and said, oh yeah, I saw that one. Thinking, of course, of the Gary Cooper one, which is not this one.
No. Also appearing as Ralph Forbes, Alice Joyce, and Noah Berry, who I thought we had seen before, but I cannot confirm it. The film opens with a mystery as Major Beaujolais leads a French Foreign Legion battalion to Fort Zindermouth. There he finds what appears to be soldiers manning the walls, but upon closer inspection, he realizes they're all dead. His trumpeter, Digby Jest, volunteers to scale the wall to unlock the gate. After 15 minutes, however, the gate remains locked and there's no word from Digby. The major climbs the wall himself. There he finds the dead commandant with a note clutched in his hands addressed to Scotland Yard proclaiming that the writer was the sole thief of the Blue Water Sapphire from Lady Patricia Brandon. The major opens the gate and returns to his troops. Returning to the fort, he discovers the commandant and the body closest to him has disappeared. He decides the battalion will camp at the nearby oasis and investigate the fort in the morning. But soon, the fort is mysteriously set ablaze. Flashback 15 years to Kent, England, we meet three young Jest brothers, Michael, Beau Jest, Digby, and John. They live with their aunt, Lady Brandon, and their cousin, Isabel. Lady Brandon struggles to afford to care for the boys and to school them, with her absent husband using all the estate's funds, but she's promised her brother to do so. When a dignitary, one Prince Ram Singh, visits, we learn that she possesses a large, rare sapphire, the Blue Water. We jump forward a number of years to when the three boys are now adults. A telegram arrives from Lady Brandon's husband that he must have the Blue Water to sell. As the family gather to gaze on the stone, the lights suddenly go out, and when they return, the sapphire is gone. No one will admit to taking it. Lady Brandon wants the stone returned by morning, or she will be very disappointed to learn that one of the boys is just a common thief. By morning, Beau has left a note with Digby that he took the jewel. Digby then leaves a note with John that it was he who stole it and leaves. John follows suit by telling his cousin Isabel that it was him and also runs off. The three boys end up reuniting as they individually join the French Foreign Legion, inspired by the tales of their aunt's legionnaire friend, then Captain Beaujolais, that they were told as children. Another soldier, Boldini, overhears them joking about the theft of the jewel and starts a series of events that threaten the men's lives and sends them on separate journeys fraught with danger. A little bit on our star, Ronald Colman was British-born and started his career on stage and in silent films in his home country. He immigrated to the United States in 1920 and began touring in the stage productions The Dauntless Three and The East is West. Director Henry King saw Colman on stage and hired him to star the 1923 film The White Sister opposite Lillian Gish. He soon left the stage and began primarily work in film. He found a success throughout the silent era, but he found even more so when he was finally able to use one of his greatest assets, his, quote, beautifully modulated and cultured voice, per Joe Franklin in his 1959 book, Classics of the Silent Screen. His first talkie success was in 1930 when he was nominated for a Best Actor Oscar for Condemned and Bulldog Drummond. Colman appeared in a number of notable films like Raffles in 1930, A Tale of Two Cities in 1935, The Prisoner of Zenda, and Lost Horizon, both in 1937.
Great stories.
He would later win a Best Actor Award in 1948 for A Double Life. In a weird twist of fate, Ronald Colman, at the time of his death, was set to star in MGM's 1960 film Village of the Damned. That film would end up starring George Sanders, who ended up marrying Colman's widow, Benita Hume. That's a little odd.
Yeah.
The desert scenes of this film were going to be filmed in Algeria, but the Rif War, a conflict between Spain and the Berber tribes of nearby Morocco, made it too difficult to travel there. So instead, the deserts outside of Burlingame, California and Yuma, Arizona stood in for the Sahara. And also a little bit of trivia, the remake of this film that came, about a decade later or so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Used the same Yuma, Arizona location. That's all the kind of the background and the notes that I had. I understand you've got some information for a change there, Lydia.
Yeah, I've got a couple of things. Let's real quickly just talk about some of the people you'll see in this. Christopher, you mentioned Neil Hamilton, I think, Ralph Forbes. You also mentioned Alice Joyce. Neil Hamilton, you guys, those of you who are better comic book nerds than I am are going to know he is Commissioner Gordon in the classic Batman, also was in some of the original Tarzan movies, not as Commissioner Gordon, by the way.
And then poor Tarzan.
And he looked so familiar. There were a few faces in this that I recognized, obviously, aside from William Powell, who I went, oh, what? And then Ralph Forbes was in Smiling Through, which we covered already on this channel, I believe.
Which one?
Smiling Through.
No, that's new to me. We have not covered that.
But he was also in, that I've seen him in, was Hound of the Baskervilles with Sir Basil Rathbone. Not one of the major players, but the other major character in that version is played by Richard Green. Also another one of my actors that I got a crush on. Alice Joyce is interesting. I don't know if we've seen her in anything, but she was really captivating to me. I kept thinking she looked really familiar, and I can't decide if she looks familiar because we've seen her in another movie or if she looks like somebody I know, and I kept thinking, why is her face so familiar? But he's almost a side character in this, but there are two Americans, Hank and Buddy, And Hank is played, and you don't really see him, and he's very young in this. You see him, but he's not the major character or one of the major characters, but he's played by Victor McLachlan. I'm going to say his name wrong, who is probably best known for being the brother of Maureen O'Hara in The Quiet Man. He plays the squire, and has always been one of my favorite characters in cinema. So it was funny to see him in this and think, oh, he looks familiar, but not be able to figure out why. And then it be because that's who he is, the only man to ever stand up to John Wayne in a fist fight. So worth a watch if you haven't seen The Quiet Man. Absolutely watch it. You guys will recognize it as that clip. Remember that one clip in E.T.? the one where Elliot's, Anyway, it's that kissing scene from E.T. But so it was fun. It was interesting to go through and see all these different characters. Before you heard their voices, before they could speak, there's so many names and faces in here that you'll recognize. And there are others. Those are just the ones that really, jumped out for me.
Yeah, you definitely sound like you had a little bit more history with a lot of them and seeing them and some latter films. Most of the names I was not familiar with outside of the ones I mentioned, obviously William Powell, Neil Hamilton, Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah.
And we did see him in it was a 1960, I think it was, The Devil's Hand, where he was like the cult leader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very, very much not Commissioner Gordon.
Right. And it's so different to see them in this when they're so young.
See, it's really funny because I'm watching it going, wait, is that him? That is him. It really... I don't even know if I recognize his face, but the occasional mannerism.
Yes.
His occasional sudden like, oh, shock.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, criminy, he still does that in 66 when he's in Batman.
Yeah, and this is 30, 40 years before that, but you still can recognize him. And it's so much fun to see. The other thing I did a little bit of digging on, just because I saw the other version, another version of this movie as a child, and it really stuck with me, and it was the French Foreign Legion. And so I think probably I'm one of those random kids that knew about the French Foreign Legion when nobody else did, but only because I had seen the Gary Cooper version of this movie. So I wanted to do just a little bit of digging on that, and I'm going to give you guys hopefully a very short history of it, but I think it's really interesting. It was preceded by a different organization in 1481. It was established by Louis XI as Cent Suisse, the 100 Swiss. It was 100 elite soldiers that were actually basically the Swiss Guard. They morphed later under Louis XIII into the Swiss Guard and went from being the personal protection of the King of France to being the protection of the palaces of France. From then, they continued to serve the French king, that is the right word for it. They continued to serve the French crown as the Swiss Guard through the Revolutionary War, but they were all massacred during the French Revolution. And so it actually completely disappeared, but that same year it was reestablished as the Free Foreign Legion, but it was basically a bunch of Dutch volunteer soldiers. Eventually that was dissolved. When Napoleon came into power, after, of course, the royals were pushed out, there was Napoleon's army, also comprised primarily of foreigners, and reminded me of Dumbledore's army, but a bit different. And the remaining regiments of that became absorbed into the Royal Foreign Legion under Louis XVIII. The first Legion... I'm going to try and pronounce it in French. The first Légion étrangère. The Foreign Legion was signed into ordinance by Louis Philippe in 1831 and then succeeded by the new Foreign Legion 4 years later. They did a bunch of action. Basically, they were in some really famous wars, including the Siege of Constantine, the Crimean War, the Italian War of Independence, the Franco-Prussian War. You mentioned, and I went to write it down, you mentioned that in 1920, they were in I can't believe I forgot what it was called. What was the war you mentioned a minute ago?
The Rif War?
Thank you. The Rif War, which is going to be right around the time that this is happening. After that, they were also in the Franco-Prussian War, World War I, and World War II. They've served in locations as far as Africa, Mexico, Indochina, basically all over the world. And the French Foreign Legion still exists today, even though we think of it as like a Victorian era or maybe a 1920s era group. They still exist, and they were involved recently in the Gulf War, Afghanistan, and according to references I found, it still operates in parts of Africa, of course under the French flag, still as the French Foreign Legion. If you want to sign up to join the French Foreign Legion, you can still do so today.
Wow, I had no idea they were still around.
I guess I never really thought about it. I always thought about them in the context of Beaugest, of the, you know, the African struggles during this period of time before and after, before World War I especially, but, you know, I just never really thought about it. So it's really interesting that they originated from something else in 1481. Officially, they were established by Louis-Philippe in 1831, but the precedence has been in place for it since the 1400s.
My history of knowledge of the French Foreign Legion come from sources that may or may not have been very accurate. The least of which, and most definitely not accurate, would be like Looney Tunes. You know, you got Yosemite Sam or whatever,
yes,
joining the French Foreign Legion.
And Bugs Bunny in the tan uniform, yes, the khakis. Absolutely.
But also in other film and television where people, it's a joke that they're going to run off and join, you know, to go and hide from whatever they're trying to run from.
Yeah.
They're going to go join the French Foreign Legion to get away from it.
Which arguably you could say probably originated with Beaugest at some level. If you want to find out more about the French Foreign Legion, I found quite a bit out on a website. It's foreignlegion.info. If you guys are really curious about it, I recommend going there. They have lots of resources, including a whole segment on today in the French Foreign Legion. So you can go through all of the different centuries and today's date and see everything that happened on today's date, you know, 100 years ago and 50 years ago. It's kind of interesting. A lot of information there. But I thought it was just interesting to find out a little bit more about it. It's a really long-standing organization, even though it has kind of morphed and changed over time. I think it's, like you said, it's like the most romanticized version of the military we can imagine.
I am curious, and I would imagine they are a little bit more selective about who joins these days versus even what's depicted in this film.
It'd be interesting to know for sure whether they're, you know, run more like the Marines or more like, I can't even think of a loosely organized military group. Certainly not one I want to mention on our podcast. There are some I could mention, but I value my life and
you're
going to
get someone upset. Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, let's not talk about that. But yeah, as far as I'm aware, you can still join up. So they actually even have a link on how to join on that website I mentioned.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So if anyone's looking for an escape,
if you need out of the country, yeah. No. But yeah, like you would imagine any regular military group at this point would appear, you know, uniforms, tanks, guns. Back then, it was more horses, uniforms, guns, not
camels.
So many tanks, camels. a lot of sand back then.
Lots and lots of sand. Yeah, thank you. That's very interesting.
Yeah, they are still operating in parts of Africa, so you could still run away to Africa and join the French Foreign Legion.
Oh, wow.
Maybe not in that order.
But let's talk about this film now, and then we can talk a little bit more about the Legion in the film and everything. This is a truly silent film. Many of the films, silent films that we've covered in the past, at least two or three of them, have had inserts of sound of talking or singing in the case of the jazz singer. If you go and search to watch this film, you can find it in many places. Most of the prints that I discovered are really poor, and almost all of them have been given an awful musical score. Many of the ones I saw and I was listening just briefly, and it sounded like 2-bit video game, you know, turned classical music or something. It was not good.
I was finding some kind of, you know, piano player piano music, like, you know, where they'd feed the thing in and the piano would play it on its own.
Sure.
I was finding a little bit of that. And I'm curious to know if you found one that you felt like had a really, like, strong musical track that you were able to watch real easily.
I did. I found one. It was on YouTube. And it's actually a really tremendous looking print. The person who posted it, he himself went and kind of recomposed what he claims to be like the original score to the film. But I will have a link in the show notes to his channel and his version, because it is a remarkable, very clean, and the music is fantastic.
That is the one I watched as well. Everything you're describing, I know from hearing what you're saying, it's the same one. And I totally agree. I went through and tried to listen to tried to watch a couple of others just to see out of curiosity. And yeah, I read the same kind of disclaimer at the beginning saying that it was, my understanding is it was taken from the original score, and it's, I think, exceptional to mm-hmm. the point where I forgot from time to time that I was watching a silent film. There are a couple of sound cues, gunshots, things like that. Not a whole lot, but a couple that really grab your attention. It kept me engaged the whole time. So I'm super happy that that exists, and I'm really pleased that I was able to watch it. I also recommend anybody that's looking for it, go to the show notes and take a look, because it is definitely an improvement over a lot of the prints that you'll see.
And if anyone's curious, if they don't want to follow the link, Silent Movie Fan is the channel on YouTube. So you go there and then search for Bojest, and you'll find it there. It's remarkable. It's just it made this a much nicer experience than I think we'd have otherwise with all the other versions that I was coming across.
I think realistically, it's probably much better sound than you would have gotten at the time when this was released. Typically, you would have had one or two people, maybe somebody playing a piano, maybe you'd get, you know, somebody with a violin or a fiddle out there. So it's not, I don't think it's very likely that it's the genuine experience, quote unquote, that you would expect to get at that time. But it makes the watching the film really nice. And even without the sound, it's a really good clean print, like you said. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to see a lot of what goes on. And in this movie, that matters. There is some decent acting in this movie.
Oh, no, very much. Now, I mentioned how this film opens, that it opens with the Legion, the battalion coming across this fort, and then all the men, you know, manning the walls are dead. And you really start thinking this is going to be like some weird supernatural mystery. I mean, it starts out really heading down that direction, especially when bodies start disappearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That all gets explained towards the end of the film. But yeah, the film starts very interesting. It's not what you're expecting. And then goes off into a couple different directions pretty quickly.
And that feels really weird when you're watching it the first time. You start off following Beaujolais and his regiment, and something happens, and then it's like hard cut. Let's go back 15 years. And that seems like a weird way to tell the story, but that actually follows the book. You can find the book of several different places. Obviously, it's technically out of copyright at this point, I believe. But unlike the Green Murder Mystery, which we mentioned last month, which is based on a book as well, this book, Bojest, actually it starts off strong, and it's very interesting read. So if you want to compare it to the source material, this is a book that actually I am in the process of getting a copy of. I'm really looking forward to reading it. I've started on the first chapter, and it does seem to follow that pattern. The first two chapters are like, it's kind of that Kipling-esque or Lost Horizon-esque kind of telling, saying, oh yeah, I ran into a man and he told me this story, and then it goes into the story. So it's just kind of a tale within a tale. It does that in the book, and it does it within the movie.
So yeah, so we go back in time 15 years. We discovered, the film tells about the three brothers whose bond, the bond between brothers is stronger than anything, according to this film.
Yeah, definitely stronger than the love between a man and a woman, which will ebb and flow, according to the quote at the beginning.
And we get to see the three boys and their cousin Isabel playing war with sailing ships on the on a small pond.
Yeah, with explosives.
With explosives and live fire.
Like you did back in the day.
Apparently.
Before seatbelts.
Even their cannons actually fired actual miniature rounds.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a BB gun probably.
Yes, yeah. It was enough that at close range, it actually punctured one of the boy's legs.
Yeah, John gets injured. He gets shot from a cannon, a little toy cannon. And then the way that they dealt with that was really interesting to me. The kids break out a knife and a match, and they sterilize the knife, and they use it to dig that little pellet out of John's leg, and they wrap it all up. And I thought, oh my goodness, parents today would be having a heart attack watching this. To me, I'm going, wow, those kids know a lot of first aid. This is really impressive. But
yeah, it's good that if you're out there playing with fire and live ammunition, that you know some first aid. I'm glad that they're well-rounded.
I thought they were just going to cauterize the wound, but no, they went in there. They did full-on surgery. Presumably, it wasn't a very deep injury.
No.
But, and, you know, momentarily, John jumps up and down on it and goes, yep, looks okay to me. So, yeah, it must not be that bad. But, you know, they start calling him from there. What do they call him? A solid fella?
Stout.
Stout fella. That's right. He's a stout fella. And you get from there the idea that he and Isabel have a little flirtation going on, as 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds do. Or 6-year-olds, however old they're supposed to be.
Yeah, so he even at one point, I forget what they were talking about, but he mentions that he would do something once they're married. Yeah. As you say, they're all of 10 years old, maybe.
Yeah, and we also, so, and he's treated to a Viking's funeral.
Yes.
In effigy, not actually, they don't really burn a little kid alive in this book, or in this movie.
I was sitting there thinking, these boats are these very ornate, they look like museum piece sailing ships that they're using and playing in this pond, and they're setting them on fire.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. The first thing I noticed is that all three of the boys have like little kid admiral uniforms, complete with the hats and everything.
All the paper hats, yes.
Yes, and like it's just very intricate. And so I guess maybe back then you got the ships to go along with the uniforms.
I guess it's just now I'm not really wondering why Lady Brandon can't afford or is struggling to afford schooling and everything when she's getting them new ships every time they want to go play Armada.
And they're giving each other, you know, Viking funerals. Yes. And Bo says to Digby, hey, if I die first, make sure I get a Viking funeral. And Digby says, you know what, if I die first, you make sure I get one. In the book, apparently, Bo and Digby are twins, which I'm a little sad that wasn't included in the movie, but I wonder too if either they just felt like it wasn't important to the storyline, or maybe they just didn't look enough alike. I'm really interested to know if that plays any part in the book, so we'll see.
All three boys looked like they were very close in age.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I could see where maybe they could be, paternal twins when you don't look alike.
Sure. Yeah. They could. I don't know if they're identical twins or not in the book, but I thought that was an interesting little tidbit that they don't even mention at all in the movie.
I think that's when they meet actual Captain Beaujolais, right?
Yes, I believe so. And also His Highness, who, do we ever find out who His Highness is?
Yeah, that was, I mentioned it earlier. It's Prince Ram Singh.
Thank you. So they meet the prince and they meet the captain at the same time.
And it leaves quite the impression on the boys.
Yes. Telling him all about all of the different, I wish I could remember. I was reading a book called Prisoners of the Sahara. It talks about, there's a whole mythos around the Bedouin warriors of this era and earlier eras. And I really enjoyed Prince Singh telling them like about it, and the Tuaregs and the veils and all of that. I just found it super interesting. So it's no wonder that as boys, they're just captivated by this idea of these desert tribes and want to go see them.
But I did find it interesting that Lady Brandon has visiting dignitaries of him from Prince Ram Singh, and then the legionnaire who's off going to war to fight the Arabs.
Well, I kind of see that as well. So without giving anything away, we later find out Ram Singh is there for a good reason. And I took Beaujolais, and he says at some point that he had long wished that he could be the one to take care of her. So I take it as them being like old friends from school or family friends or something like that. And the fact that they're there at the same time is just a coincidence. But I took it as Ram Singh being, and maybe I'm completely missing it here, but I took him as being a Hindi royalty, not Middle Eastern.
You know, you
royalty.
Are probably right. I'm showing my American ignorance, I think.
No, I'm showing my penchant for all things Indian. Anything historical and foreign, I really enjoy.
Especially so. With the name right there, Ram Singh. That would definitely, yeah.
I've seen
sorry.
Way too many Shah Rukh Khan movies.
I am definitely showing it. Please excuse me. I've been up since very early this morning.
Well, and you're probably not a massive girl fan, like fangirl of Shah Rukh Khan either, so it's okay. And anybody that is like a big fan of Shah Rukh Khan out there, like, you know, let's solidify here, like, yeah. Yes, Shah Rukh Khan fans. Sorry. I just have a whole list of actors that I just blush.
We never find out where her husband is and why he's spending all the money.
Well, he's obviously an aristocratic playboy. Aren't they all?
It?
Oh, yeah, I took it that way. But I also, bear in mind, guys, I read and write romance novels. So it's not a surprise that that's immediately where my mind went to. Yeah, I took that as she has brought on, the book specifies it, I think the movie does too, she's taking care of her sister's three sons and her husband's niece. And so here she's agreed to take in all these kids. Now I can extrapolate, maybe they weren't able to have their own children. And so she just decided, I'm going to bring all the kids here. And he was like, oh, you can't give me kids, I'm going to just go off on my own. Or maybe he was a playboy from the beginning. I would be very interested to know if the book specifies, but I think you're right. The movie, we're just left to our own devices to guess.
But yes, this 1-2 punch between the prince and the captain is definitely leaves an impression on the three boys. So it's no surprise that in the end, you know, when they decide to go run off. Yeah, it's a nice setup to get us to where we need to go for the film.
I agree. It's almost like it was intentional.
Well, there are lesser films, I suppose, that wouldn't even bother with the flashback kind of thing. You would just have these guys end up in the Foreign Legion because why not?
Yeah, I have to imagine that is owed directly to the source material here.
Yes,
that,
yes.
You know, it was the thought out story that was written into a book and then turned into a movie. Interesting, within 2 years, I feel like that's very quick. Maybe it was just the age of Hollywood. They were desperately looking for material and would grab anything that caught their attention.
I was wondering about that last month with the Green Murder case, because that novel had only been written, I think, the year prior.
Yeah, and it seems like with the Red House? That I have it in my head that it was written not too long before the movie was made also.
I believe you're correct.
I could be mistaken. But yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, it's interesting that it seems like books got made into movies very, very quickly in the past. And that doesn't seem like that's the case now. In fact, it's almost like the opposite. It's almost like they don't want to. Oh, I should just stop. original stories be darned.
I think you're onto something with, at the time, being a burgeoning industry, there isn't really screenwriters.
Yeah.
There are, but not as many as what you might be able to find today.
Yeah.
And so it is a case of, well, we need to make movies. We don't make money if there's no movies in the theater, so we need to make movies, but we need someone to write the movies. Base it on the book. Grab a book. That book's supposed to be good. Let's do that.
Yeah, that's I think remarkably insightful. That sounds exactly like what I would imagine would have happened. Now, back then it was silent films anyway. There's not a lot of dialogue. And now you have so many people desperately trying to get into the industry, or did at least at you know, in recent history, that Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. They didn't have a lot of source material back, or they didn't have a lot of dedicated writers back then. How interesting.
Yeah, so once the boys are grown up, the jewel is apparently stolen. None of the boys will fess up to it. They all admit to or claim that they're the ones that stole it and run off.
I loved that scene. The whole way that scene unfolded. There, I feel like the scene with them as boys, it felt a little long to me, especially the first time I watched it. But this scene where the diamond disappears, it's the sapphire.
Sapphire,
when
right?
Yeah, when it disappears, I just was captivated. Between the acting and between the direction, it feels a lot like what you would see on a modern film. You know, mm-hmm. You see the hands sneaking over to flip the switch off. You see it goes dark, which I thought was probably really effective at the time to have the screen go black and then come back up and it be the same scene. That must have been, really
captivating. Did the
really
film break? Is there something
wrong?
Yes.
Like, oh, wow. And then, and then it happens a second time and you're told it's going to happen a second time. And there's so, so much interaction that happens here. And I really think in this scene in particular, I think that Alice Joyce is wonderful to watch in this scene. Her reactions feel like modern acting. And I know we mentioned on a couple of other movies where it feels like she could be a modern actor. It's just so nice to watch that, where it doesn't feel like it's a pantomime. And in this case, she's just like that. I think some of the direction with some of the guys is there's some back and forth, but a lot of the expressions feel very genuine.
Yeah, that's something I only just now kind of realized when you mentioned that. There's not a lot of pantomime. Is many of the films from this era, there are still a lot of actors, acting to the back row.
Yeah.
This one does feel very modern in how it's filmed.
There's almost none of that. And there's definitely a little bit of jerkiness to some of the motion. There are some, some missing frames, things like that. But in by and large, it feels natural to watch it. The behavior, the events that happen, the weaselly guy, Boldini, is that who
yes.
William Powell plays, even though, yeah, he's definitely that weaselly guy from the movie, it's William Powell. And so
right.
He doesn't come across as being a goofy actor. He doesn't come across as feeling really ingenuine. Now, and there are some direction choices, I think, that maybe would push it toward that, mm-hmm. where I wouldn't expect to see William Powell act in this certain way, but I feel like those are direction choices, him being hoisted up by all the guys when he first tries to steal something, and shunted along on top of the group. There are some things like that where maybe it doesn't feel exactly natural, but the acting in general is very good. The direction is very good.
I was going to say, I think the one actor, funnily enough, that does occasionally feel a little exaggerated is Boldini.
Yeah.
Is
and
William
he's supposed
Powell.
To there, be.
Yeah, I think so. But
yeah.
the he is the one where he's hiding behind on the other side of the wall and he's practically twirling a mustache.
Yes. And a mustache that they actually give him a mustache, like a very pronounced, he's supposed to be a sketchy Italian con artist. Or at least pretending to be a sketchy Italian con artist.
Mm-hmm. But after seeing William Powell as the detective in the Green murder case, or
yes.
the Thin Man, if anyone's
yes.
watched the Thin Man,
or literally
or,
anything else,
or my man Godfrey,
yes.
To see him as the snivelly and unscrupulous thief in this film.
Yes.
It's really kind of cool.
It is. I totally agree. I'm happy you said that. It is weird. It's very strange. But it's like, imagine seeing Benedict Cumberbatch as the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be like, this is so weird. Like, I like it, but it's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. It was really neat seeing him get to play a different side. And after reading how he felt about playing the detective in the film last month, mm-hmm. where he like found it boring because you stand and think, you
yes.
sit and think, you lay
yeah.
down and think. I would imagine he had more fun with a role like this.
Yes, definitely. And yeah. there are a couple of, there's at least one standout stunt, I think, in this movie that involves him. Whether or not he's the one that actually performs that stunt, I don't know. But but the character in general is interesting. He's definitely a linchpin. The character is there to be a linchpin to make things happen. But even with that, even knowing that, it doesn't feel horribly contrived.
The filming and the directing and the choices they make, and I'm sure it's in the book and everything, is he's caught stealing, and the punishment is enacted by the men. They effectively drive a stake through his hand. You mm-hmm. don't see it, but it's definitely implied. And we see him putting bandages around his hands. Mm-hmm. And later in the film, there are you still see a mark on the top mm-hmm. of his hand. Mm. I don't know why. It's just, especially in a film of this age or of this time, when I see that kind of effort mm-hmm. putting into continuity, it impresses me.
Yeah, I agree. I got nothing to add.
No. Okay.
I think the other really interesting character, well, interesting character, the other obvious bad guy character in this is, I'm going to have to go to his name.
Sergeant Lejeune?
Whose name I can't figure out how to pronounce, so I'm glad you said Lejeune. Let's go with that.
That's the one downside. That is definitely a downside of the silent film.
Yeah. He is possibly the most hateable character in any movie. And then you become really confused because then it turns out he is like the most determined character you've ever seen. He's complex.
Very complex, and our own heroes even realize that. They're ready to help the men kill the guy, and then they realize when their back's against the wall, hey, this guy is pretty much our only chance at getting us out of this mess.
Yeah, and I think they say, if he dies, let's forgive him.
Yes.
I kept thinking of Captain Ahab.
Okay.
He's this horrible, horrible person. And then when he gets to the point of being under pressure, when he's to the point of doing his purpose, he is just unstoppable. And he's so interesting for that reason. Obviously, you're supposed to dislike him. He's easy to hate. But then I like how complex they make it. They just make it really, you can't just write him off as a dime store villain. He is awful, and he is clearly greedy, but then he also holds it together, and then then seems completely mad, completely insane near the end, and you know, telling them all, "Hey, let's all laugh really hard, make them think we're in here having a good time when almost everybody's dead," you know, I can't imagine anybody playing this character better than Noah Beery does. He is phenomenal at it. And every point of this character hits exactly how it's supposed to. And, you know, again, I think we have to give some big credit to the director, but also what an exceptional job of being the most hateful, capable person you've ever seen in film. He just is. He's awful, but then you're also like, wow, but he also holds it together when everything's going wrong, or holds it together in a sort of insane way anyway.
Yeah, yeah. No, there are, I don't know if there's any character in this film where you just feel like, well, that's cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. Everyone has got their moment. Everyone has their moments mm-hmm. throughout this film. There's some great moments when the one brother is being kind of, you know, effectively terrorized by the sergeant, and the other brother wants to go help, and the third brother's got
holding
his arm
back.
Locked and like just let it go.
Yeah.
Don't cause trouble.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I think they're all exceptional. So, I think what other real highlights of this movie do we want to talk about?
maybe the fact, I mean, they went to a desert anyway, outside of Arizona or California, and they did a remarkable job making you feel like you were on the other side of the world.
Yes, absolutely.
The fort, there was no moment where you felt like you could just look just to the left of that screen and see LA or something.
Or even film trailers. Yeah. I never thought of that the whole time watching this. And it's hard not to think of that kind of thing once you've been doing this kind of thing for a little while. If you studied film at any point in college and they made a point of ruining movies for you, then it's really easy to think, oh, just off screen there's this, or just off set there's that. But in this movie, I never even thought about it.
Mm-mm. And the set of the fort, and then the fact that they actually burned the thing down at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they get the shot.
Did they really burn it at the end of the...
It looked like it. Certainly they had a lot of smoke, and I don't know how you make that kind of smoke without fire. So either they were really good at controlling flames.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe that is just movie magic in 26. Yeah. That is some impressive movie magic. Or they just finally said, okay, we're all done with it. Light it up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely interesting. I saw a tidbit that said that they filmed the later remake of this that I keep mentioning with Gary Cooper. They filmed it in the same area. Mm-hmm. So apparently they did such a good job on this one that they were like, hey, let's just use it again. I don't know that it was the same set or anything like that, but the same area.
No,
it was effective.
I did mention that the Yuma, Arizona, I think, is the same location that they did the remake.
Oh, yeah, that's where I read that, from your mouth.
Yes.
From your lips. It's funny, the only location that even really could feel much like a set, exterior location, let's say, is where they're playing with the boats at the very beginning. But even that, there's a pond, there's a fountain. You know, it's interesting because in this era, this is the era known for, you know, lot scenery, backlot scenery.
Sure.
I mean, certainly that you could get away with it the easiest. And it looks like everything was filmed in some sort of a realistic location. That's a lot of fun.
Did you have any idea, you know, the solution in the end, you know, why the boys did it? What the actual core problem, I guess?
That's a great question, because they do mention in the room when the sapphire disappears, one of I think it must be John says, well, that means I can't get my degree in Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
And Bo kind of makes a face and kind of, he says something, and I don't know if it was you're right or no, you'll get to go anyway. I'll make sure of it. You know, I'm not quite sure, because I don't think they gave you a title card for that or a dialogue card. I mean, it was obvious that it had been taken for the benefit of the family. But as far as the, let's say, penultimate solution, just to make ourselves sound very educated. No, I had no idea. So maybe going back to last month's conversation, maybe we should talk about the end of this movie. But if you haven't seen it yet, stop it now and go watch it. You actually gave away a bit of a spoiler in the synopsis by mentioning that the guy who goes and climbs into the fort is...
Digby. Mm-hmm.
John, isn't
it? Was it John? I thought it was Digby.
John, I thought. Because John is the one that shows up. I'm pretty sure John is the one that shows up last. So Digby and Bo go join the Foreign Legion together. And John, after they've both left, I think catches up with them. And so at the very beginning of it, it is one of the Jess brothers. And I didn't realize that. And so then as the end is unfolding, and obviously, you know, you're the whole time, the question is, did one of them really steal the sapphire? Like, obviously somebody did, right?
Right.
But there are six people in the room, including Lady Patricia, including Isabel, and I believe there's a servant or somebody there at the same time.
Yeah, I believe you're correct.
And so somebody else could have taken it. And so the question is, did Did they really take it? Do they have it with them? Did they already sell it? You know, all of these questions that are going on. And then at the end, then of course, you know, when all three of the guys are claiming that it was them that did it, any of them could have done it. Definitely, especially under the argument that Bo said he did. I think I wrote him down as William, but he's actually Michael. That Bo did it to protect, said he did it to protect the other guys. So, you know, Bo writes a letter and says, Digby, I took it. You know, don't come looking for me. And then Digby writes a letter and says, John, I took it. Bo's just protecting me. Don't come looking for me. And then John tells Isabella, they're both lying. I did it. Don't come looking for me. And it's, you know, this great, it's such a great setup. And you know, and the whole time the audience doesn't know. And I didn't realize that it was one of the brothers that it shows up and is the trumpeter. I should have, because we get a little foreshadowing of that when they're little boys playing and one of them is playing on the bugle or the trumpet.
There you go.
It's yep. Such a great little, you know, foreshadowing or hind shadowing, whichever you want to call it. But yeah, I had no idea that, obviously I knew, well, obviously I believed somebody had taken it, and obviously I believed it was one of the guys, and I believed that it was, he had taken it so that eventually John would be able to go back to Oxford. That was what I had thought was the case. And then come to find out, I guess we're spoiling it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then come to find out that when Lady Patricia had earlier said, you know, I'm doing this thing because I have no other choice. And she said that.
She said that to Sing. The prince.
Yes, mm-hmm. To the prince Sing. She's talking about selling the sapphire. And the sapphire that is then stolen is a fake, which, gosh, even knowing that at the beginning of the movie, you would have been like, it's a fake sapphire, who stole it, right? And then, but to not know that.
This is an advantage, I guess, of the silent film, is you see her talking to Sing, and, you know, I do this, you know, just to protect my family. You don't hear any other words. You don't know what else is going on.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time, Bo is hiding behind a suit of armor, mm-hmm. overhearing the thing. Mm-hmm. He overhears the entire conversation. So even as a young child, he knows that the gem is gone.
Yes.
That it's been sold.
But we don't know that.
That's a secret. We don't, because we don't get to hear it.
Yes. But I love what I like about this is, but you are given the it's not a deus ex machina, because the event happens in the story before we know about it, and it's alluded to. It doesn't just show up at the end of the movie. Oh, and by the way, that was a fake sapphire all along. No, like he says, you know, we find out that everything that he did was because he knew it was fake. And so he was trying to prevent her. He was trying to prevent his aunt from the embarrassment or the financial destruction of that being, of it being found out that it's a fake sapphire. She's already got the money. It's really great. I won't talk about my reaction to this movie yet, but no, I had no idea that that was where it was going.
I think it's really great. It's one of those things that once you realize what had happened, there's clues in the film. Like early on when Sing is there, it's like, oh, can I gaze upon it? You know, can I look at it? And one of the boys says, well, what would something like that be worth? Oh, well, if I was allowed to buy it, it would be a lot of money. And yeah. There's almost like a nudge, nudge, wink, wink between yes. him and Lady Patricia.
Yeah.
And you're not sure what's going on there. And you're thinking, is he planning on stealing it? Is he going to be the villain? You know, you don't really understand what goes on. And then what's with Patricia and her conversation with Sing? Mm-hmm. Are they in a relationship? What exactly is she doing here to save her family?
Yeah, why is she taking money from him? What did she do? Exactly.
Right. Well, you don't even know that she's taking money.
Oh, he hands something to her, and I guessed it was money.
Okay.
But then again, I've got a smutty mind, so...
Yeah. Well, they come in from another room and that, yeah, maybe or maybe not, something changes hands. And she says, I only do this to protect my family. I'm thinking,
right.
Is this film going where I think it is in 1926? What is she doing exactly?
Well, they do call it the oldest profession. So, yeah, I'm the same. I didn't expect it to happen, and so, or I didn't expect the reasoning behind it. And then going back, knowing it and going back and rewatching it made it I almost want to say more enjoyable, not more enjoyable, but not a disappointment at all, because now you know what's happening and they back it up every scene of the movie. So mm-hmm. This is a movie where you can tell that the plot was worked out ahead of time. We've seen some movies on this podcast where you're going, gosh, did they even know what the end of the movie was going to be when they started making the movie? It doesn't seem like it. You know, did this movie actually have an ending? Some of the movies we watch don't have endings. And this one, it is very plotted out from the very beginning, and it's supported the whole way through. And it makes it, we have a tendency to go through and watch something like this one time and then find something else similar to watch, you know, if we enjoy it. But this is a movie that it really bears going back and watching it a second time, because then you're in on the joke, you're in on the backstory, and you get to see all of the ways that they support everything that happened in this movie. And I have a strong feeling this is one of those movies that the more you go back and watch it, the more things you notice about it. I've mentioned The Lady Eve from time to time is like that. I feel like this is probably one of those movies too. And when you start to realize, oh, you know, somebody does this here. Oh yeah, Boldini winks at him and like, you know, has him do this or that. I think there probably are mannerisms and things like that that you pick up over time or over rewatching that would make it maybe a little bit sweeter to watch again and again.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to go ahead and wrap this up and put a rating on it then?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that.
Okay. Go ahead. You were kind of on a tear there, so I'll let you go first.
Yeah. So this is interesting. I think I have to think about it in the context of when this movie was made. You know, when we've rated movies, we've said, well, if you're going to watch a silent film, or if you're going to watch a Ronald Coleman movie, or, you know, if you're going to watch this or that, then, you know, I would rate it this way. It's worth mentioning there are a lot of versions of this book. There are a lot of versions of this movie. there is notably the last remake of Beaugest of 1977, which is a comedy. Oh. And it has, I can't think of the name right now. Somebody's shouting it right at me. One of my listeners is shouting, Marty Feldman. Does that sound right?
Yeah. Okay.
Marty Feldman, I believe, wrote it, maybe directed it, and yes. So it looks and feels like something that would have been made by Mel Brooks.
Which, you know, Marty Feldman was a, you know, definitely in the Mel Brooks stable.
Compatriot.
Right.
Absolutely. And so it looks really funny. The ad for it gets interrupted. It says, we interrupt this ad for another ad. And it goes into a camel salesman thing, like a whole spiel. It's, you know, I haven't seen it. It looks hilarious. I hope to find it. There are, of course, a lot of serious makes of this story. And there are a lot of spinoffs of the story. Christopher, you mentioned Looney Tunes. You know, there's a later movie with Gary Cooper in it called Unconquered, where they do the same kind of thing, where you've got all the gentlemen at the top of the walls are all dead, but they do it to keep off the fighting forces, to trick the fighting forces into believing, you know, that they're still there and able to fight. It's really interesting. There are a lot of instances of this movie, and there are, I'm sure, very good instances. There's at least one made for TV instance of it, which was interesting to see, I think 1983. And of course there's a book of it. Frankly, yeah, if you get the chance to read the book, if you like classic literature, read it. If you've read Lost Horizon, if you haven't read Lost Horizon, read Lost Horizon. If you have read Lost Horizon, read Beaugest. This version of this movie with these actors and this director in this setting is as close as you can get to a perfect movie in this era. It is so good. Interestingly, it is not a romance. I almost always need some element of romance in it, even though there's a little side bit about there being people that love each other. I don't consider that to be a major part of the story. But I can't think of any reason not to give this movie 5 Othels. We usually say stars on accident, but it is an Othel rating system. And so I just can't think of a reason not to give it. There are some, maybe there are probably little quirks here and there of the time. You know, like I said, there are some skipped frames, things like that. It's not a perfect film across every era forever. It's not the best movie in existence, but for a film of this time, especially 1926, a silent film, the cast is, you know, it's a stellar cast. The acting is excellent. Alice Joyce, I think, is really standout in it. I think she's wonderful. The relationship between the brothers is incredibly enjoyable. Every character has a purpose in this story. You don't feel like they just threw somebody in there to be the comic relief. You get the Americans, Hank and Buddy, but even though they're kind of in there a little bit funny, they're still important to the story, important to the end of the story especially. And they're enjoyable. You're like, oh yeah, I'd have a drink with those guys. So yeah, I have to give this movie 5 Othels. I think if you're going to watch a silent movie, especially with the remarkable composition by Silent Movie Fan and the quality of this film that's on that channel, I 100% recommend it. I think this is a 5. I think it's hard to find. Aside from Safety Last with Harold Lloyd, which is a comedy and therefore completely different than this movie, it is really, really hard to think of another movie from this era that I would say just kicks this one's backside. This for me is it. Of what we've seen so far, of what I've seen so far, this to me is the best of the silent movie era.
I am not going to bore everyone by repeating a lot of what Lydia just said. I will just add that it managed to do something that many other silent films that I've tried watching has not been able to do, and that is to keep my attention through the entire running time. At no Absolutely. Point did I feel like, oh, I'm going to look at my phone, and oh, did I miss something? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you know, none of that. I was riveted to the screen because I wanted to see, I didn't want to miss any moment. I didn't want to miss any title cards that came up. And this film actually mm-hmm. has quite a few.
I mean, which is great. Oh,
it is very, thank you, Bojess, for having as many title cards, because there is so much going on that you need a lot of dialogue. And, you know, this film, despite it being silent, still gives you that dialogue. It is enjoyable. The production value, I think, is impressive and some of the best that I've seen of the era for sure. As you said, the cast is astonishing, and now I'm going to start running into you're repeating things that you said. But I will agree with you. I think this is a 5 Othel movie. Certainly, it is the best silent drama that we have covered on this show, which we haven't covered a lot. We really are only getting into the silent films more recently. But yeah, this was astonishing. I mean, I will still go back and watch, what was it? The Iron Mask?
Yeah.
That was still a whole lot of fun.
Oh, yeah.
This one, I don't know the proper adjective to give it. Is it fun? Is it interesting? Is it...
captivating.
You took the word right out of my mouth. I was just getting ready to come up with captivating. I think that is this one. Yeah.
Yeah. As you were listing them off, the only other one I thought of was Cyrano. We also watched that phenomenal version of Cyrano, Cyrano de Bergerac. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I keep forgetting other ones that we've seen from this era.
Was that a silent though? Cyrano de Bergerac that we watched was not silent.
That explains why I didn't think of it right away.
Yeah, with Jose Ferrer.
That sounds right. Yeah. Okay, well, so there's interesting for you, because I had it kind of in my head that one was silent.
No, that one was a talkie. I would put that one right alongside this one and say even quality, even though they're two very different films.
So was that, am I finding this right? Was that 1950?
Mm-hmm.
So we're then putting a 1926 film on par with a 1950 film that we also rated extremely highly. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, is a big comment about Bojest. I think that says pretty much everything. Yeah, so you're right. It wasn't silent. I think everything's silent.
I think this film is ahead of its time. This feels like a film that was made much later, and for some reason, the soundtrack was lost.
Which is great. I love that it wasn't, because it tells me that there was this level of quality at that time. Yeah. And who knows how many movies are no longer available that existed at this level.
Oh, now you just made me sad.
I actually made myself sad. I almost said, let's have a moment of silence.
Yeah, I feel like there needs to be one. Yeah, I just shudder to think of all the films that have been lost, and we have no idea what they were, and that there could be another Beau Gest that out there that rotted away in some vault somewhere.
Yeah, maybe there's one in somebody's attic right now, hopefully. Because they do, every once in a while, they find, hey, this movie was just discovered. It was in somebody's attic or somebody's basement. Yeah. So cross our fingers that in the future, we'll find even more amazing films like this one.
I hope so.
I literally cried twice watching this movie. I cried twice watching a silent film, which is, that says so much to me. I'm an easy crier, but I don't usually cry in silent films because I think that there's so much of this. We've already talked about the soundtrack, which is just excellent for it. It fits so perfectly. And so that actually makes me sad that there aren't more extant soundtracks or extant compositions for those silent films, because a lot of what we see, they just slap music onto it so that you're not bored watching it literally silent. But if this is... if this is a legitimate example of the type of composition that was provided at the time when these movies were being released in theater, they're phenomenal. They're so much better than we think they were, because the music and, you know, whatever sound effects were timed for the movie. And it makes it a completely different experience than just slapping an organ grinder soundtrack onto it. It just is a completely different experience. Yep. I hope somebody will go back and do this same thing for more silent movies. This is the first film I've seen on Silent Movie Fans YouTube channel, and it makes me really interested to go and see more and see if they've done the same thing with other films.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have not had a chance to explore the other videos on his films. I don't know if there's all that many, but if he does put this kind of effort into a film, I wouldn't expect there to be a lot.
Yeah. This, by the way, this episode is not sponsored. We just, both of us ran across the same very good version of this movie. And so, yeah, in case you guys are going, are they starting to pick up sponsorships? No, we're not. Not that we're not open to them, but this is just genuinely somebody worked really hard on this, did an exceptional job, and deserves
credit where credit is due.
Absolutely.
All right, well, that will do it for Beau Gest. If you guys have gone and watched the film, please write us, let us know what you think of the film, orphanedentertainment@gmail.com, or comment on any of the social media sites. Lydia, thank you so much. Always a pleasure, and this one was even more so.
It makes me want to go watch more Ronald Colman films, because it looks like there are a number of his movies, even as old as this, that are really highly rated on some different sites. So I'm excited to, and of course we've seen him in other things. I've seen him in other things, but makes it worth it to go look for more.
All right, that's going to do it, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back in a month. Until then, take care. Bye.
Bye. We'll be back for Halloween. Ha 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 ha.